Please be warned that this program contains mature subject matter and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
If I was a snitch, he would torture me himself. He would kill me himself, and that he would spend hours torturing me first.
You're listening to My Aryan Princess from the Dallas Morning News, written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. I'm Christopher Wynn. If you haven't listened to the previous chapters, go back and start from the top to get the whole story. Chapter 3, Team USA.
Carol slid on sunglasses, tucked her blonde hair under a black hoodie, and power walked across a six-lane street in Tulsa, Oklahoma. She could have been anybody, which was the point. Minutes later, she took a booth by a window at a Brahms ice cream store. She pecked out a message on a cell phone keypad. "I'm here." A black quad cab truck with smoky windows pulled into the parking lot. Carol darted from the restaurant, a front door opened, and she disappeared inside. It was January 27, 2012, a warm but unremarkable Friday, under a mid-morning sky the color of wet cement. A year had passed since federal agents orchestrated the epic arrest of Carol's fiancé, Michael Crash Bianculli, after he stole thousands of dollars and double-crossed agents from Homeland Security investigations and officers in the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. After the theft, Aryan gang members implied they would rob Carol's family and ransack their home if she didn't pay Crash's debt. Terrified, she called the only cop she knew, HSI Task Force Officer Steve Lair. That instant changed the trajectory of her life. Carol agreed to give Lair her Facebook password, a minor concession, she thought, and to send him text messages if she heard anything interesting about the gang. It was a loose promise, one easily forgotten. Lair did not press. Carol came to him, each time more eager to please, offering insight into past crimes and forecasting the gang's plans for others. She provided background on ABT officers and dished on their girlfriends. In time, what began as a casual distraction became her full-time preoccupation.
A big part of this case was built on the development and cultivation of confidential informants.
I don't like being scared, but no. Look what it did. I will be in fear my whole life.
There was no climactic moment, Carol said, or even a quiet, conscious choice. Over weeks and months, the work gradually yielded a new identity. Snitch. "Maybe I thought I could make a difference," Carol said years later. "Maybe I got talked into thinking I could make a difference." The ABT murdered 29 people from 2002 to 2012, more than any extremist group in the country. 12 times, the gang executed its own members, suspected of leaking information to police. Carol signed as a confidential informant at the end of that bloody decade, in Tulsa. Lair eased the black truck through a remote-controlled gate behind the county jail and parked in front of a khaki-colored work trailer. He told Carol to get out, look forward, and follow another agent through the front door and into a back office. She sat across from Lair's boss, HSI Supervisory Special Agent Pat Smith, a Hollywood handsome, 6'5" cowboy given to plaid shirts with plaid yokes. But on this day, he wore a navy blue suit with a small American flag pinned to the lapel. He and Lair had driven from Dallas to sign Carol as a paid spy. "The first rule is not to get ink on your agent," said Smith, joking about Carol's unsteady fingerprints. Over the next 90 minutes, he learned Carol built computers, had taught software to Hewlett-Packard customers in Plano, and was often asked to do online research for the ABT. After running a criminal background check, Smith asked if Carol had previously worked as a snitch, perjured herself in court, or if there was anything in her past that might compromise a court case. She paused. "Well," she said, "there's a half-naked picture of me on Facebook." Smith laughed and left the room. He came back with a stack of papers. He handed Carol two pages of rules: confidential informants may not carry a gun, take illegal drugs, or participate in crimes without approval. He asked her to read each one out loud and sign at the bottom. Carol was assigned a covert name, Julie Baker, and a confidential number. Her photo uploaded to the federal law enforcement database at 2:53 p.m. Smith stood and extended a hand toward Carol. "Congratulations," he said. "You're now on Team USA."
So I would overhear things, and I wasn't blind to exactly what was going on.
Carol arrived in Tulsa the same way she had arrived most places in her life: broke, desperate, and dependent on a man. Her new companion was Stephen Good, whose nickname was Red, a wave at his tangerine-colored head stubble and ruddy complexion. With a muscled, 6'3" frame and a violent rap sheet, he once tried to run over a cop, he cut the profile of a man prone to throw a punch. But to Carol, he was milquetoast. "Stephen was sweet, and he never raised a hand to me," Carol said. "But, God love him, he wasn't the smartest guy in the world." Red held the lowest rank in the ABT, soldier. But he had gained the favor of Larry Slick Bryan, the gang's top general, when they were locked up in the mid-2000s. When paroled, Red had parlayed the connection into a key job: three-weighing mail. Gang members in Texas prisons are prohibited from sending letters to each other. The ABT circumvents the rule by posting notes to loyalists outside prison, who repackage the messages in new envelopes and mail them to the intended inmates. Red and Carol lived in a small apartment southeast of the city. Each morning after Red left for welding class, Carol read the gang's mail to Lair. He spent hours on the phone retyping them until an agent came by with a field scanner. The letters were gold. The feds profiled ABT officers, gained insight into the gang's narcotics trade, and began to understand its violent rituals. But while the intel was valuable, it provided a limited perspective, like looking into a backyard through a hole in the fence. Carol soon improved the government's view. Charles Chaos Mail, an ABT major serving life for murder, worked as Slick's right hand, calling shots and settling disputes. He was a prolific writer whose correspondence often contained code. Carol considered his letters a challenge, like straining to read Sanskrit on the bottom of a pool. If she could drain the water, the symbols might make sense. So she built a spreadsheet with the name, inmate number, and mailing address for each gang member who sent mail. She also noted anomalies, frequent phrases, number sequences, unique names. One day, Carol noticed slanted block lettering and the consistent way he numbered pages. She snapped a photo and sent it to Lair. Over the next few hours, they studied his other writing until they picked up a pattern. It was a Rosetta Stone moment. Using the key, the feds unlocked ABT secrets. Agents charted the gang's entire membership by rank, mapped its drug drop houses, and connected criminals to unsolved crimes. "I had no idea what a big deal it was until later," Carol said. "And I'm sure there's a bunch of stuff I don't know." She's right. Carol's amateur detective work exposed James Birdman Bird, a killer who once soaked a slice of bread in a victim's blood and ate it. And James Chance Burns, who ordered soldiers to use a blowtorch to burn an ABT tattoo off a man's torso. And Terry Littlewood Sillars, a general who eventually betrayed the Brotherhood and became the government's star witness. "I had no idea what I was getting myself into," Carol said, "or how much I would love it, and how much I would come to hate."
"I'd like to be married and, you know, have a dog and, you know, the house. Anything can happen."
The Arkansas River begins as a drip, 2 miles high in the Rockies, where ice melts into a trickle, into a clear and cold trout stream, into a tumbling and treacherous boil, cutting its way through granite canyons. Water thunders out of the Colorado foothills, but is gradually tamed in the Great Plains. By the time it slides through Tulsa, the silt-brown channel runs wide and river barge deep. Caro and Red walked hand in hand along the waterway many nights after dinner, a couple in a romantic blush. "You can't help who you love," Caro said, "and I loved Stephen." Red bought Caro an engagement ring with a fake diamond at Walmart, a placeholder, he said, until he could afford the real thing. "It tarnished my finger a nice color green," Caro said, "but I still wore it." On weekends, they shot pool at a smoke-choked honky-tonk, fed quarters into a jukebox featuring Buckcherry, and threw up the ABT's ace-deuce hand sign after tossing back shots of Jägermeister. To Carol, it was too good to be true, romance without violence. She brought Red coffee each morning after his shower, with 2 teaspoons of sugar, and opened his Bud Light after dinner at night. Little things to show love. Even so, she spent most days trying to send her fiancé and others to prison. Carol breathes contradiction. Inhale, and she's a fervent featherwood, an unapologetic racist, radiating contempt for brown and black people. Exhale, and she's a force for good, a warrior princess, risking her life to put violent men in prison. Which portrait is true? When Carol gave Lair her Facebook password, it was easy and effortless, like wading into the shallow headwaters of an infant river. Even as water rose and ran swift, Carol kept her balance, reading letters to Lair by day and loving on Red at night. "I never decided to be a CI," she said. "I just kept getting involved in shit and kept getting deeper and deeper." And later, as she shot through Whitewater Rapids, Caro believed she could survive by outthinking the ABT. "I'm a good liar," she said. "I had to be. It was the only thing that kept me alive." Mental agility made her a good CI. Once, after a birthday party for an ABT officer, Caro remembered names, family relationships, and a few phone numbers for 14 people. The typewritten report filled a page. By the time she and Red left Tulsa 3 months later, Caro had helped break an ABT code, provided information on a drug kingpin, and made key friends in the gang's hierarchy. Her profile surged in both groups, and she was invested in both. The Brotherhood satisfied basic needs for drugs and shelter and friendship, and her commitment to the feds filled her with a sense of purpose. What Caro found in the AB and with the feds is that people respected her and paid attention to her, said Ike Blevins, Carol's dad. They became her surrogate family. There was nothing she wouldn't do for Steve Lair.
Someone would become a CI for multiple reasons, maybe they're pending charges, for one. And the other reason is some do it for financial reasons.
The investigation was wider and deeper than Carol could have known. For 3 years, ATF Special Agent Richard Bonning had led a task force of 80 local, state, and federal officers representing 20 agencies. 7 case agents, including Lair, ran the day-to-day operation, logging evidence, tracking reports, setting up surveillance. Carol never knew what the feds were up to, and for the most part, she didn't care. Lair was obsessed with all things ABT, but that seemed to be his way, maniacally focused, intense to the point of bulging veins. "I was driven by his passion and commitment," Carol said. He'd say, "I know you can do it. Here's what we need." The next morning's phone call always felt good. "I'd have a ton of information, more than he even asked for," she said. And he'd say, good job as always." The feds paid Carol one time in Tulsa, $500, a sum they called cultivation money. Lair told her she could earn more by working hard. But Carol keyed on something else, he said. "When this whole thing is finished, the government might help her start over." Lair called it a hard reboot, a new identity in a new city, a second chance. Since her first hit of heroin at 15 and the velvety drift into a razor wire world, Carol had prayed for a miracle, a road to Damascus type conversion, leading back to a middle class life. A doting husband, dinner on the table, dry cleaning. Snitching, she hoped, would clear the path.
So you always want to make sure that your CI's identity is never disclosed, or that the ABT, in this particular case, doesn't know who your CIs are.
Murder, if it's ordered, it's nothing to these guys. They're so loyal. And that's, I think that's the scariest part, is how loyal they are, and you don't cross them.
The feds harvested information from thousands of sources during their six-year investigation of the ABT, but fewer than 15 people worked as cream-of-the-crop confidential informants. They took the risk for their own reasons. Federal agents use the acronym MICE to describe CI's motives. Money, ideology, compromised, ego. Recently, officers added revenge to the list. Carol didn't fit comfortably into any category. They were like brothers to me, Carol said, but they were also terrible, horrible criminals. Carol worked blind and up close, and in time became one of the investigation's most savvy civilian operators. Some of her success can be chalked up to chance. One boyfriend could pick up the phone and call the ABT's top general. The next was used as a post office box for the gang's most sensitive messages. But Carol's uncanny run continued in coming months. Time and again, she ended up alongside key figures, at critical times, collecting incriminating information. ABT officers knew they had a mole in their midst. With each arrest, they became more convinced it was Carol. Until one climactic moment, alone and without backup, she acted on raw instinct.
My Aryan Princess is written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. To hear the remaining chapters of the story, visit dallasnews.com/ABT for direct downloads and links to our show in Apple Podcasts and other audio players. You'll also find exclusive DMN subscription offers at dallasnews.com/listen. Thanks for listening.